Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Brian Furline. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome and thank you for joining us for today's educational activity titled Initiating Medication-Assisted Therapy for Opiate Use Disorder in Diverse Settings, Clinical Pearls for Navigating the Process. This activity is brought to you by CME Outfitters, an award-winning accredited provider of continuing education for clinicians across the globe. I'm an associate professor of psychiatry at the Yale School of Medicine, and I'm the director of the Psychiatric Emergency Room at VA Connecticut Healthcare System in New Haven, Connecticut. I'm joined by my colleague, Dr. Tobias Wasser. He is the chief medical officer of the Whiting Forensic Hospital in Middletown, Connecticut, and he's an assistant professor of psychiatry at Yale School of Medicine in New Haven, Connecticut. Tobias, let's start by having you walk us through some of the learning objectives.
Thanks, Brian. There are quite a few challenges and pitfalls in successfully managing opiate use disorder. Today, we're going to focus on the best practices for managing opiate use disorder in VA settings, correctional facilities, outpatient, and ER settings. Our first objective is to examine the neurobiology of opioid addiction relative to the efficacy of opioid agonists and antagonists in reducing illicit opioid use. Our second learning objective is that we hope that by evaluating the evidence to support the use of MAT and addressing the barriers, that you'll be able to increase the use of medication-assisted therapy in your practice. And finally, our third learning objective is that we hope that the information we discuss today will enable you to incorporate best practices for the use of MAT for opioid use disorder in diverse settings, including the VA system, criminal justice settings, hospitals, and outpatient clinics. Now, Brian, we have an animation of the addiction pathways to share with our audience. Would you like to begin with a virtual tour of the addiction pathway?
Thanks, Tobias. So you can see on the animation an outline of the human brain. And there are a variety of parts to the brain that are involved with the reward system and the development of an addiction. So I'm just going to briefly go through a few of the key elements that are related to the addiction process. First, you'll see on the animation a flashing yellow and a flashing purple. And you can see how the yellow will start to expand out into the purple. Now, a few of the elements that I want to point out here are the amygdala, nucleus accumbens, the hippocampus. These are all elements that are deep within the brain, involved with a system called the reward system. Now, if you think about the reward system for us, we have a reward system because we need to reward behaviors that are important for survival. Now, it could be survival as a species, or it could be survival as an organism. So if you think about behaviors that are important for survival as an organism, you might have things like eating, drinking water when you're thirsty, finding shelter. If you think about behaviors that are important for survival as a species, you might think about sexual activity, which for obviously for procreation. You might think about social interaction, raising children. These are all things that are important for procreation and survival as a species. So you take those two things together, the reward system serves a very important purpose. And that reward system is really centered deep within the brain where that yellow will start before it starts to expand out to the cortex, primarily the prefrontal cortex, the area in the front part of the brain, the larger part of the brain. Now, the cortex is what separates us from lower level organisms. Across the board, most organisms will have a reward system, and that is really designed for survival. Very important system, designed for survival. But we have a cortex, and most of the time, we don't need to worry about survival. So we need to worry about, how did I do in school? How is my job going? Is my boss upset with me? Do I have enough money to pay my bills this month? I'm worried about things that are necessary for my long-term livelihood, not necessarily short-term survival. So the prefrontal cortex and the cortex, both integrated with that reward system, as you can see on the animation and the pathway, they're related, but they often contradict each other. The reward system wants immediate survival. It wants to do something right away that is necessary to keep us alive, but the cortex wants to do things that are necessary for longer term planning and longer term things. And sometimes those things contradict. If I had a platter full of food in front of you, one had chocolate cookies, another platter had carrots, your reward system would say, eat the chocolate chip cookies, very calorie dense, we don't know when we're gonna eat again. The cortex would say, eat the carrots, healthier option, less calories, less weight gain, less problems in the future. So this system, which is very, very important for survival, for us, isn't as necessary anymore because we're rarely in a situation where we won't survive. But then you introduce drugs of abuse. You introduce cocaine, methamphetamine, or opiates, as what we will discuss today. When you introduce something like heroin, this is way more powerful in the brain than food, way more powerful in the brain than sexual activity. So the reward system begins to think that this thing is now the most important thing to this person. Heroin is now really important for survival because you activated me and I'm an important system for survival. So heroin now becomes as important to an addicted brain as water if you're thirsty, or food if you're starving. So when that process occurs and that reward system starts to take over the behaviors from the cortex, we say the disease of addiction develops. And that's going to be sort of a foundation for when we think about addiction. We have to understand that when this reward system hijacks the cortex, the single most important thing to that addicted brain is the next use of that substance. So this animation is available on the CME Outfitters website, www.cmeoutfitters.com. We encourage you to go to the site and download the animations and use it with your team or use it with your patients. And I often will describe things like this to my patients to help them understand the process that they're going through. Now we're going to go to the impact of opiate use disorder. Having that as a foundation, once that brain develops that addiction, what are the problems that this causes? What is the impact of this disease in our community, and what can we do to help? So as you can see, opiate use disorder is often undiagnosed, it's often undertreated. And there are a few examples here, as you can see on the slide. For example, the percentage of one state's Medicaid members who are on high-dose opiates, the percentage of them who do not have a diagnosis of opiate use disorder is in 82%. So you can just imagine the number of those patients that likely have an opiate use disorder that's simply undiagnosed. For each opiate-related death, it's estimated that 10 to 20 people overdose but don't die. Very important for things that we'll get into later. If you think about how many overdoses there are that often go undertreated, in the sense of we're not getting the patients into treatment. And again, we're going to discuss this in a few minutes. MAT, medication-assisted treatment medications, they're often prescribed very, very rarely. So in one study, it was less than 25% of publicly funded opiate treatment programs were using medication-assisted treatment, and less than 50% in privately funded opiate treatment programs. So this is a disorder that's very underdiagnosed and very undertreated. And if we think about it another way, for every additional 40,000 people, which is a small percentage of those with opiate use disorder, for every additional 40,000 people who are given access to MAT, 200 overdose deaths could be avoided each year. So we have the opportunity to make a really, really, really big difference if we can make sure we're diagnosing enough and treating those who need to be treated. So I think people often underestimate the collateral damage of opiate use disorder. So Tobias, could you talk us through some of the effects that you've observed?
Sure. So as we all know, you know, the opioid crisis is really striking the nation, and it takes no prisoners. So, you know, individuals with opioid use disorder, the disease not only has an impact on the individual, but also on their families, their friends, their coworkers, and their communities. It's had a significant impact on the foster care system. So we've seen a dramatic increase in the number of children referred to the foster care system. For example, over 2 million children now live in households in which at least one parent has an illicit drug use disorder, which often leads to referrals to Child Protective Services, the Department of Children and Families, whatever the acronym is in your locale, which then often leads to foster care placement. Also, there's significant impacts on the economy due to lost productivity, less discretionary income for individuals, and this is estimated to be in the tens of billions per year. So it's a huge economic impact.
How effective is MAT, medication-assisted treatment, as part of a long-term recovery, Tobias?
We know that MAT is extremely effective, and one of the most seminal studies that demonstrated this was a 2015 study in the Journal of Drug and Alcohol Dependence by Weiss et al., which demonstrated that for individuals who are on MAT for 18 months, they decrease their use by 80%, or between 10 and 20% at 42 months. This was after patients were stabilized on their medication-assisted therapy and then tapered off. And at all three follow-up points throughout the study, patients engaged in MAT had markedly higher odds of positive outcomes compared to controls.
So, Tobias, we really need providers or cross disciplines to be active in treating opiate use disorder. There was actually an interesting study about nurse practitioners and PA utilization of medication-assisted treatment for opiate use disorder discussed at ASAM this year. What were some of those highlights?
Yeah, so that was a study from the Journal of Addiction Medicine, and it was a very recent study, and it sampled a little over 100 nurse practitioners and another 100 or so PAs. And It essentially found that many of these allied professionals were really unaware of new MATs that were available to them or the best practices for the use and or rather for the treatment of opioid use disorder. Only less than half were actually waivered to prescribe buprenorphine, and many were much more confident in their ability to diagnose opioid use disorder than to actually treat it itself. So it demonstrated that we're really not doing a good enough job as a medical community of making sure that all providers at all levels are both educated and capable of treating appropriately opioid use disorder using the best available evidence.
So there are additional barriers to prescribing medication-assisted treatment among primary care providers who have taken the training and become waivered. Often we see that there's just some barriers there, even though they're waivered. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so there was a recent study by Eleanor McCants-Katz that was published in the journal Addiction. And it surveyed over 4,000 clinicians in 2018, and 3/4 of those clinicians had prescribed buprenorphine at some point. And the average was that they had prescribed to 26 patients in the past month. However, only 13% of all the providers were actually prescribing at or near their maximum limit that was allowed under their waiver. And the main three determinants that were found to be barriers to ongoing treatment were, they said, a lack of patient demand or requests for MAT, which seems to suggest that we're not doing a good enough job of educating our patients about the available treatment options for them for their opioid use disorder. Second most common was time. They said that they didn't have available time to both provide the MAT and all the necessary elements like urine drug screens and other components of evidence-based practice. The third was insurance reimbursement, feeling that they were not being appropriately reimbursed both for the interventions and the time it took to facilitate the interventions. So Brian, we're gonna be talking today about a number of different settings to provide MAT for opioid use disorder. It seems that we ought to start with the emergency room. And given that you're the director of an emergency room in the VA system, I thought perhaps you could talk to us a little bit about the feasibility of starting MAT in an ER setting.
Yeah, so this is a great question. And starting buprenorphine in an emergency room setting sounds intimidating, and we'll discuss in a few minutes some of the ways that we do it. But we want to start by giving you data. So there's clear evidence that initiation of buprenorphine in an emergency room is incredibly helpful. And there was a study by Gail D'Onofrio out of Yale, a colleague of mine. I was not involved with the study, but a colleague of mine in the medical emergency room. I'm the director of a psychiatric emergency room. This was out of a medical emergency room, where they looked at three different things. They looked at, these were patients who came into an emergency room with opioid use disorder. They looked at three things. Either they're just gonna refer the patient to treatment, that was one group. The second group is they're gonna do an intervention, so they're gonna speak to the patient, give them a brief intervention, and then a referral to treatment. And then the third group is they're gonna do that, plus they're gonna add buprenorphine and provide a prescription for buprenorphine. So if you look at the three groups, primarily at the two-month follow-up, you can see very clearly, statistically, that the group that was given buprenorphine was far more likely to be engaged in treatment at the two-month mark. So what we're trying to accomplish here is these are patients who are very sick and who desperately need help and often only present to the medical system through the emergency room. And now we have an opportunity, even if it's for a short period of time, to get them engaged in treatment and hope that the system will then take over from there. So as an emergency room provider, I see my role as one, seeing the most sick patients who are coming in to see me. These are patients who are following an overdose, patients who are desperate, patients at the end of their rope. I see the sickest patients. I may be the only doctor they see that year. And now I have an opportunity to try to get them engaged in treatment. And one way to do it is to initiate buprenorphine and is to get them started on it, hopefully feeling better, and hopefully keep them maintained in treatment. And I think this study laid the foundation for us as to how we were going to start doing that in our emergency room.
Wow, that's really interesting. Now, you mentioned, as you were talking about Dr. D'Onofrio's study, that she directs a medical emergency room and that you're the director of a psychiatric emergency room within the VA Connecticut system. Now, the veteran population is a particularly unique population, and I thought maybe you could give us a little bit of an overview of the use and treatment, the treatment of opioid use disorder within the veteran population.
Yeah, so, veterans have high rates of many illnesses. Veterans have high rates of PTSD, of alcohol use disorder, and of opioid use disorder. And you can see some of the statistics here that 66,000 veterans were treated by the VA for opioid addiction in fiscal year 2016, 66,000. So these are large numbers. And keep in mind that the veteran population is a relatively small percentage of the overall U.S. population. So you think about those numbers, it's a very large number. So we have really the opportunity to make a pretty big difference. Soldiers returning from deployment experience chronic pain. Chronic pain is very comorbid with a variety of psychiatric comorbidities, but also increases their risk for opiate use disorder. But despite these numbers, it's about 25% of veterans with opiate use disorder who are receiving medication-assisted treatment. And these are similar numbers to what we saw on a slide a little earlier, where this problem tends to be underdiagnosed and tends to be undertreated. So we have an emergency room in a setting that we're trying to really make a difference.
And can you talk a little bit about why in the emergency room setting it's important not just to detoxify patients, but to try to get them on maintenance treatment?
So when I was a fellow, Tobias, like one of the things we had to recite was detox is not treatment, detox is not treatment. And it's fascinating in the world of substance use disorders where patients, families, often clinicians think that if I could just detox the patient, get them off of the opiate, get them through the period of time where they're sick, that everything will be fine. Mm-hmm. And that's all we need to do. Mm-hmm. But it's really not the case at all. And if you think about diabetes and you think about diabetic ketoacidosis, which is a very common complication of diabetes, if someone came in diabetic ketoacidosis and we treated that diabetic ketoacidosis syndrome and we gave aggressive medications, we admitted them, we intubated them, we gave them insulin, whatever we needed to do, and we did a great job, we saved their life, and they felt better and they were ready to go home. And then we didn't address the underlying diabetes. We just sent them home without any treatment for the diabetes. It's probably fairly reasonable to think that they might come back and still have diabetes and maybe even have diabetic ketoacidosis again soon. Substance use disorders are very similar. The detox component of a substance use disorder is one piece. The underlying substance use disorder is another piece. And if you only detox a patient and then send them home without any treatment, it's very unlikely that they're going to maintain a long-term period of sobriety because they still have an underlying problem that you didn't address. You just addressed the short-term problem. There's a very good study here that really exemplifies this. And this study was really designed to look at comparing two groups, detox only, which is the orange group, and getting them on maintenance therapy, which is that purple group. And you can see in the study, it wasn't a large N, but it definitely shows the picture here, where the group that was detoxed only, everybody had dropped out of treatment by, you know, day 30 or 40, essentially. And this was a year-long study. And what's not on the graph is that 25% of people in that group died before the end of the year was even over. The other group, which is that purple group, you can see the vast majority of people remained in treatment. So it's really, really important that we understand that detox alone tends to not work very well, that we have to address the underlying problem. And one of the ways we can do it is to not detox people, but to get them on maintenance medication. And doing it through the emergency room, if you're able to within your system, is one way you can do it. And that's something we're going to be talking about soon.
Wow, those are really impressive numbers, Brian. And I really like the analogy of the individual diabetic ketoacidosis. I think that draws a really important parallel between, you know, sort of parity issues around the treatment of medical illness versus the treatment of behavioral health disorders. And I think it's really powerful, particularly for our colleagues who may be in a medical discipline as opposed to a mental health or behavioral health discipline, to help appreciate the importance of treating the acute illness, but also providing ongoing chronic treatment for a chronic illness.
Tobias, you're right. I'll just add to that. Not only do a lot of medical providers not address that, but often get frustrated with patients. Mm-hmm. When a patient has an opiate use disorder and they detox and then they discharge the patient without any treatment, then the mm-hmm. patient comes back 3 days later and they're still using, the clinician often gets upset with the patient and says, mm-hmm. Why are you still using? You told me you would stop. We detoxed you a week ago. Why are you still using? And then people can become frustrated and feel as though it's a hopeless situation. When if the provider just understood the underlying problem is still there and needs treatment, maybe it would at least avoid some of these bad feelings we have towards the patient sometimes.
I could definitely see how people would both get frustrated by that and how perhaps educating people about the need for ongoing treatment might help to both alleviate the frustration and obviously also provide better care. Now, I know in the VA Connecticut system, you guys have a lot of really wonderful resources and well-organized systems for providing treatment for opioid use disorders, particularly given the vulnerability of the veteran population. I wonder if you could maybe tell us about that.
Yeah, so Tobias, I'll tell you a little bit about what we do. And keeping in mind, for those of you listening, you may have a totally different system. The point of telling you a little bit about what VA Connecticut offers is to give you an idea of one system, what one system can offer veterans or patients, and what you might be able to do within your system to either add things or simply take what you have and try to work with it. So on the slide are a few examples of the services that VA Connecticut offers. You can see, as I mentioned, we have a psychiatric emergency room, and that right away is not that common. Very few VA hospitals have one. Community hospitals often have psychiatric emergency rooms, but we have that. That's sort of the highest, most acute level of care that we would offer for mental health services. Then we have a variety of inpatient services, and in most hospitals will offer many, if not all, of these things. We have an inpatient psychiatric unit. For us, it's relatively small. It's only 16 beds. If we're full and we're unable to admit people to our unit, we will transfer veterans to local hospitals for the same type of care, an inpatient psychiatric hospitalization. We have what is probably a little bit unique to us is we have a detox service. We call it detox service, although we don't really think of it as detox. We think of it as stabilization. And what that service does is it provides a walk-in clinic every day without an appointment where patients can come in during the day, during the week, be assessed for their detox needs, whether it be from opiates or alcohol or others. And they can either get initiated on buprenorphine, they can be given medications for alcohol detox. If the patient is unstable, of course, they can come to the emergency room. If the patient is a little bit more stable and is able to do an ambulatory detox, we have this walk-in service without appointments that's always available. That's incredibly helpful for us from an emergency room to refer patients to. Then we have other detox facilities we can send patients to. We have treatment programs. Again, detox, not treatment. We have treatment programs. We have a 21-day program at the VA with intense groups. We also have treatment programs in the community that we refer to. And then within the VA outpatient world, we have opiate treatment program, which would be a methadone clinic. We have a specific buprenorphine clinic. We have a dual diagnosis clinic for veterans who have mental health problems in addition to substance use disorder problems. And then we offer a variety of groups, such as CBT, contingency management. And of course, we refer everybody to AA or NA when appropriate. Now, if you think a little bit more specifically about what we do in the emergency room to set the stage for how we would initiate someone on buprenorphine, we have a psychiatric emergency room that is a 24/7, 365 locked unit. There's only a few at the VA that we know of. There may be a few out there. We haven't gotten a clear number. There's definitely none other in our VISN, which is our local area, which includes New England. We have a capacity of 14, and we're able to provide an extended period of observation, which is particularly helpful when we're trying to initiate buprenorphine, which we'll talk about in a second. Our patients are mostly voluntary. We, generally speaking, don't take too many police holds. Community psychiatric emergency rooms tend to take more police holds than VA hospitals because we're a federal institution and police holds generally adhere to more state laws. And we don't really adhere to state laws so much as federal laws. So we tend to have a very voluntary population who is generally agreeable to staying to get help, who generally wants help. Our unit is staffed by approximately 30 providers. And we run 24/7. So we have attending level providers staff the emergency room 24/7, all of whom have a waiver to prescribe buprenorphine. They've all received the training. They all have the waiver, and they're all able to prescribe buprenorphine in the emergency room. So we have a system designed where it's covered all the time. Patients come in. Doctors, whoever's on, is able to see the patient, and if appropriate, write for buprenorphine.
So can you tell us a little bit about the process for initiating buprenorphine in your VA system?
Yeah, so this is a really nice flow sheet, and it gives you an idea of what we would do. So if you look at the top line, everybody who comes in is going to get a formal evaluation. They're going to get a full H&P, a physical exam is part of that, a drug screen. We're going to check various things. Now, if the complaint is directly related to opiate use disorder, then we will initiate a COWS, which is a clinical opiate withdrawal scale, which is designed to test for symptoms of opiate withdrawal. We often usually get collateral information from family, from friends, and from their doctors. Most veterans who come to the emergency room are already connected to care somewhere else at the VA, so we have access to all of their records. We also have access to their providers. If it's during the day, during the week, we can give them a call and get more information. So we have a lot of information available to us, as well as a thorough examination of the veteran. Now, if it's appropriate, and we've determined that the veteran has an opiate use disorder, and it's indicated to initiate buprenorphine, we're going to observe the patient for a long enough period of time for them to go into withdrawal. So it depends on what they're using. That could be a couple of hours if they used last night and it was a fast-acting opiate. It could be longer than that if they were using methadone, for example. They may need a day or two before they might have enough withdrawal for buprenorphine. And that's one of the advantages of a psychiatric emergency room is that we're able to hold patients a little bit longer than community medical emergency rooms often hold patients. We can hold patients for a couple of days if needed to get this process fully initiated. If it's appropriate, we would generally start with 2 or 4 milligrams of buprenorphine, depending on the patient, depending upon how much they were using, depending on medical comorbidities, the age, etc. Most opiate use disorder patients that we see are younger and reasonably healthy, so we can usually give 4 milligrams at first. Then we wait, reassess them in an hour or two. If it's not enough, we will give an additional 4. Generally speaking, 8 is the maximum on day 1. Then on day 2, we would reinitiate whatever they got on day 1. If they got a total of 8, we would give an additional 8. And then we would probably go up to 12 or 16 on day 2. If they only needed 4 to stabilize on day 1, we may stop at 4 or 8 on day 2. It just depends on the situation. There's no one size fits all for this. These are general rules. In general, the patients will stabilize by 12 or 16 milligrams by day 2. And day 2 could just simply be the next day. So you're talking about maybe a 24-hour period we have patients stabilized and feeling much better. But then we have to figure out what we're going to do at that point, right? So we have the patient, maybe they were there a day or two, now they're stabilized, they're ready to go. So sometimes they will do this process in the emergency room. Sometimes they'll do this in the detox clinic that I mentioned. Other times they'll do this in a detox facility. Again, I use the word detox, but these are all facilities not necessarily to detox, but to get them initiated and stabilized on buprenorphine. No matter what, at the end, we need to refer these patients, right? They need to go somewhere. So we have our buprenorphine clinic, we have an ambulatory clinic. We have everything set up at VA Connecticut where we're comfortable that at the end of this process, patients are going to be able to be referred and get the buprenorphine that they need. And some community providers may have a harder time with that. So it's very important that there is an established relationship between the emergency room and wherever the veteran or the patient is going to be going to continue with their buprenorphine. Now, having discussed buprenorphine in detail, there are a number of FDA-approved therapies for opiate use disorder. They have varying pharmacology, varying formulations and dosing frequencies. So in addition to the buprenorphine, Tobias, could you tell us a little bit about some of those other modalities?
Sure. So as you alluded to, there are essentially 3 different types of treatment, medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder. And it depends quite a bit on their pharmacological profile. And you can look at the table here for lots of the details, but I'll try to summarize each briefly. So the first is methadone. So methadone is a full mu opioid agonist. It's available as an oral solution, liquid concentrate, or as a tablet or powder. The dosing frequency is daily. And these are only provided through approved methadone clinics. The second class of medication, which is becoming much more popular, is buprenorphine or buprenorphine in combination with naloxone. Buprenorphine is a partial mu opioid agonist. And the combination with naloxone is important just to prevent diversion. So that's becoming a very common mode of administration. So buprenorphine is available as a sublingual tablet, an implant, and as an extended release injection. And both for subcutaneous use, and also there's a depot injection that's being worked on right now and is pending FDA approval. The frequency of those vary based on the kind of formulation that you're using, and you can see those there. And the combination of buprenorphine and naloxone can be taken as a film, either sublingually or as a buccal film, or just as a sublingual tablet. And then finally, we have naltrexone, which is a full mu opioid antagonist. And that's available as an extended release injection. And the idea of that is to prevent the individual from using, opioids. And that's available every 4 weeks. Anything you want to add to that, Brian?
No, so I mean, I will say that, as we'll talk about in a minute with the data is looking pretty good for, particularly for extended release in naltrexone. So we're going to discuss that. So I was wondering if, I mean, Tobias, if you have some of this data, you want to, you know, go do a little overview of some of this data?
Sure. So the next slide here demonstrates the results of a Lancet study by Lee et al. This was a 24-week open-label randomized control comparative effectiveness trial in an outpatient setting after patients were induced onto their treatment in an inpatient setting. And it was a comparison of monthly extended-release naltrexone compared to daily sublingual use of buprenorphine. So fewer participants in this trial successfully started the injectable naltrexone compared to the sublingual buprenorphine. You'll see the numbers there. It's about 3/4 versus 94%. At 24 weeks, though, amongst people who were able to successfully initiate treatment, both medications were actually equally safe and equally effective. During their treatment, outcomes were somewhat better for the buprenorphine group than the naltrexone group, but not significantly so. So you'll see that comparatively, once you get people onto treatment, they're actually almost equivalent medications in terms of their safety and their effectiveness. But it is a little bit easier to get people to start the sublingual tablets as opposed to the monthly injections. However, once you get the monthly injection into the person, as we well know, you've gotten a month of treatment into them, as opposed to individuals who have to take the sublingual tablet on a daily basis. There's a risk every day that they won't take the medicine.
So we'll show you a little bit more data. If you look at this slide, we're looking at 12-month outcomes of recovery from opioid use disorder following buprenorphine XR treatment. So this is the extended release form of the buprenorphine that was mentioned. And if you look at some of the data here, this is within 12 months following recover enrollment, half of the participants self-reported complete abstinence, despite the lower prevalence of additional pharmacologic opioid use disorder treatments. So it's really remarkable that at a 12-month period, again, this is a very difficult disorder to treat, that at a 12-month period following enrollment in the study, nearly half of the participants self-reported complete abstinence. I think there's a lot of interesting pharmacology on the horizon, right? We have extended release forms of buprenorphine. We have extended release forms of naltrexone. Of course, we have methadone. We have the normal forms of buprenorphine. I think it's really important that we continue to look in some of these data, as Tobias and I have discussed over the past couple of slides, are really, really promising for showing that medications really, really have an important role for the long-term maintenance of opiate use disorder. Now, we can also think about the short term.
Sure. So speaking of which, Brian, you know, I think although we're not specifically focusing on naloxone today, it's such an important part of the treatment and prevention in opioid use disorder for overdose prevention. We'd be remiss if we didn't spend at least a little bit of time talking about it. So do you want to tell us more about the use of naloxone in ER settings?
Yeah. So Tobias, I think this is really important. A lot of people, much like detox, a lot of people think if I just sort of reverse the overdose and, you know, save the person's life, that'll be enough to get them to stop using. There'll be a wake-up call there. It's really unfortunate because naloxone is so important for saving lives, but it's really the beginning of treatment. Patients need to be referred into treatment. But the data showing that naloxone is being severely underutilized. If you look at this data between January 1st and June 30th over a couple year period, 5,930 ED patients had a positive urine screen for opiates, and only 2% received a prescription for naloxone when they were discharged. So this is a group that is using opiates and is at risk for overdose death, and naloxone being such a safe and such a widely available overdose prevention medication, but yet such a small percentage are receiving this medication. And you can see in the second bullet, 1,730 ED patients had naloxone administered in the ED, and only 4.4% received a prescription. So these are patients who needed it upon arrival and still didn't receive. One out of 25 or 20 received this medication upon discharge, which is really remarkable. So naloxone is being underutilized. And when it is utilized, we need to understand that naloxone is not the end all for the addiction. We need to then follow up and figure out what we're going to do next. So Tobias, we can switch gears a little bit. There is another population that cannot be overlooked. It's the incarcerated population. And this is a high risk group. And I know that this is a population you work with. This is what you're an expert in. Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences with incarcerated populations and some of the challenges that you've encountered working with this group?
Sure, Brian, I'd be happy to. So, you know, given that many, opioids, either illicit opioids like heroin or the obtaining of prescription opioids that are not for the individual, often these individuals accrue legal charges either at a state or a federal level. The correctional and the criminal justice system is going to be a really important point of intervention for the treatment of opioid use disorder because of the high likelihood that individuals with opioid use disorders are likely to encounter the criminal justice system. So as you'll see on the figure here, 1 in 3 individuals with opioid use disorder will be arrested at some point during the course of their illness. So we know that all these individuals we're talking about treating in emergency room settings, outpatient settings, VA settings, 1/3 of them are likely to be incarcerated at some point. During that point of incarceration or interaction with the criminal justice system, the majority will not receive treatment for their opioid use disorder while they're incarcerated. As a result of this, they're going to go through forced withdrawal. Now, forced withdrawal likely contributes to significantly increased risk of overdose due to 2 major factors. One is the craving for opioids because they're going to be forbidden from access to opioids during the course of their incarceration. And so when they get out, their cravings are going to be increased and their tolerance for opioids are going to be reduced. So, you know, a really common pattern that we see, and I know you're very familiar with, is individuals who are forced to be taken away from opioids for a long period of time don't appreciate that what they were using before they were locked up is not the amount that they're going to be able to tolerate when they go back out. And so they're going to go back to their same pattern of use, although their body has significantly reduced tolerance to the medication, and they're at much greater risk of overdose and potentially death. So as the slide says here, death rates will surge many fold in the weeks after release from incarceration due to an opioid overdose. And forced withdrawal reduces the likelihood that the individual will ever re-enter treatment upon release. So this, as the slide says, less than 5% of people on community supervision will actually be referred to receive first-line therapy for the opioid use disorders.
Yeah, Tobias, I'll just add one thing. We often educate patients in the emergency room about overdose prevention or harm reduction. And we say, don't pick up where you left off. Mm. And if patients, prior to incarceration, prior to treatment, prior to any period of abstinence, if they used to use 10 bags of heroin and then they had a period of abstinence, we say, don't pick up where you left off. Don't use 10 bags of heroin when you get out. Start low and go slow because you've lost your tolerance. Mm-hmm.
That's so true. And so, you know, as we'll see here in this next slide, some of the barriers and challenges to, initiating MAT in the correctional justice setting. So, you know, according to a study by the Federal Bureau of Justice, of the over 5,000 jails and prisons in the federal system, less than 30 have a methadone or a buprenorphine program. So, I mean, you know, it's less than 10% of individuals even have access to the appropriate treatment. And when they did a national survey of the medical directors from state and federal Department of Corrections, they found overall a preference for abstinence-based policies as opposed to MAT. Now, and I think a lot of this has to do with the misconceptions about addiction, the incorrect association that forced withdrawal will cure the opioid use disorder, that they ignore the risk of relapse, and they have a lack of education. They don't fully understand the risk that they're exposing the patients to. They're not familiar with the data that we're talking about today, about the significant increase in relapse rates, in risk of opioid overdose death. And I think also probably some of the challenges of providing medication-assisted treatment in the correctional setting. So, of course, the risk of diversion is very high. That's something that really has to be accounted for, certainly if they're going to provide methadone or if you're going to provide buprenorphine. Naltrexone is probably the easiest form of medication-assisted treatment to provide in an incarcerated setting, given that it's not associated with the highs of certainly methadone or buprenorphine. That it's available as the long-acting injectable, so there's not the risk of diverting it to other individuals once the injection's given, the person's treated for a month. And as the data demonstrated earlier, although it's harder to initiate the long-acting injectable of naltrexone, once you're able to initiate it, the rates of safety and effectiveness are almost comparable to sublingual buprenorphine. I guess as the long-acting injectables of buprenorphine become available more widely, that'll be another mechanism by which correctional facilities will be able to provide this treatment much more successfully.
Yeah, you know, I can see correctional facilities really utilizing the extended-release naltrexone injection. It's not a controlled substance. It doesn't have any street value. It is safe. The patient will be there for a period of time. They can get through the withdrawal, give them the injection. It will protect them to some degree. So it's really a positive sign that that data is starting to look good. Are there positive outcomes from treatment versus forced withdrawal in this population that you've seen?
Definitely. So again, looking at a study that was done by Moore et al. Is published in the Journal of Addiction Medicine in 2018. So they compared a methadone maintenance continuation group compared to forced withdrawal, a little less than 200 people in both arms of the study. They found that people who continued treatment were less likely to receive disciplinary tickets. So for people not familiar with the correctional system, these disciplinary tickets are given out for essentially bad behavior. So it can be something as simple as talking back to a correctional officer, or something as serious as assaulting another inmate. But in general, fewer disciplinary tickets is a good thing for a number of reasons. So that's of interest to the inmate themselves, because accruing additional tickets can extend the period of time that the person might be incarcerated. And so having fewer tickets, you can get more credit for quote unquote good time and get out sooner. And it's really of interest to the correctional setting itself, because fewer disciplinary tickets leads to greater safety and security for the institution. So this is one really appealing aspect of providing maintenance treatment in the incarcerated setting. They also found that after 30 days after release, 40% of the people who received treatment compared to 10% who didn't had re-engaged in treatment in the community. So this is much better for long-term outcomes, obviously. Further, inmates who engage in methadone maintenance treatment with the same provider before, during, and after incarceration were much less likely to recidivate or return to the incarcerated setting, which again is much more appealing to people who are running prisons and jails, because it means that you're going to keep your population down.
Yeah, Tobias, I think the combination of many patients with opiate use disorder wind up incarcerated, and then the incarcerated time is a time in which it can be very high risk following release. I think it just sets people up to have very dangerous outcomes. But there are best practices out there, right? And I think best practices are such a good way for us to learn a little bit about what we might be able to do different. So the Rhode Island Department of Corrections launched an interesting model for medication-assisted treatment in their population in 2017. Can you tell us a little bit about this one, Tobias?
Yeah, so Rhode Island, as you said, their Department of Corrections is really leading the way in terms of the best practices. And they've employed a new model that's been in existence for just 2 years now. So the data is early, but it's really promising. I think Rhode Island has the good fortune of being a very small state. And given the importance of connecting individuals with opioid use disorder to treatment in the community, having small areas that are working together in close collaboration is really important. Now, obviously, that won't be replicable in larger states. But if you can break it down by county or other smaller distinctions and make sure that the correctional setting is pairing with their community partners for continuation of treatment, I think that will really help. And it'll be demonstrated in the data I'm going to talk about now about the significantly positive impacts it has on outcome. So in the Rhode Island model, individuals who come into their DOC system are screened for MAT, and they're initiated on a protocol. If they screen positive, they can receive methadone, buprenorphine, or naltrexone based on their risk profile and the patient preference. And anyone who was receiving MAT prior to incarceration is continued on it without forced tapers or discontinuation. And as I mentioned, they have a system of 12 community-located centers of excellence to connect people to for treatment at the time of discharge from their correctional facility. So in this next slide, you'll see they compared data in this particular study that was published in JAMA Psychiatry of the first 6 months of 2016 before this model was implemented, and then to the first 6 months of 2017 after they had implemented the model. Now you'll see they had approximately a very similar number of admissions. The releases were also pretty similar, and the number of individuals receiving MAT went up dramatically from 80 almost fourfold to 303. And then you'll see the breakdown of the kinds of treatments they received there. Naltrexone was the least appealing, only four individuals, with the most going on to methadone and also a significant number receiving buprenorphine. Interestingly, there was a reduction in the number of naloxone kits that were given at the time of incarceration, or at the time of release from incarceration. I'm not really sure what to make of that. Perhaps it was a little bit of overconfidence in the treatment they were providing, but as we well know, we want to be providing naloxone kits regardless. Now, the next slide demonstrates really the most important result from this entire study, which was that as a result of this new model, when you compare the 2016 data to the 2017 data, there was a 60% reduction in death for those who were released from incarceration. And that's huge. I mean, that's mostly accountable to the reduction in opioid overdose death. So we could see that identification of OUD in the criminal justice setting and then linkage to treatment and treatment after release from prison was a really promising strategy to reduce death related to opioid use disorder.
It's crazy to think about that this is a disorder of young people, and one of the things we look at is reduction of death. To have a 60% reduction of death is quite remarkable. So really, I think we could learn from what some of these best practices are doing. Another strategy for getting individuals involved in the criminal justice system, the help that they need is through this drug court. I know a lot of systems have a drug court. There was an interesting study presented at ASAM about the experiences of the Miami-Dade County Adult Drug Court. Can you give us some of the key insights from this study?
Sure. So for people who aren't familiar with these specialized courts, for individuals with substance use disorders, there are some counties, as Brian alluded to, many, it is becoming more popular across the country, who develop these specialized courts. Now, based on the type of charges the individual incurs, so if they get a drug-related charge, as opposed to going through the typical criminal justice system, they'll be referred to a specialized drug court. The drug court usually has specialized probation officers or other individuals who are connected to the individual, and it helps link the individual who's incurred the charges with treatment. And the idea is a diversionary program. And the idea is that if you participate in the treatment, you do what you're supposed to do, that at the end of that period of time of treatment, your charges will either be dropped or reduced or something to that effect. These have generally been pretty successful across the country as a helpful way of trying to get people engaged in treatment and to reduce recidivism. So in the Miami-Dade Drug Court, the one and the connection to the treatment at Jackson Behavioral Health Hospital, they found that on average, people were engaged in MAT treatment for about 10 months prior to successful graduation from the program, and that it wasn't only helpful in reducing their risk of recidivism, but in fact, it was very helpful in connecting them to ongoing treatment, which we know is going to be so helpful for them. So over 80% of the individuals who graduated from the drug court, meaning they had successfully completed their program, their charges were reduced or dropped, actually continued on in treatment through that behavioral health hospital program, and that's just so important, as we know, for reducing their risk of relapse and recidivism and all these important things we're talking about.
Excellent. So today we wanted to provide you with an overview of specialized populations for opioid use disorder and some systems of care and how these different systems of care can make a difference. Tobias, thank you so much. Great conversation. Really, really interesting to get your perspective and your expertise. We work with difficult populations, the incarcerated population, the veteran population, opiate use disorder. Let's summarize a few of these SMART goals. We want SMART goals, right? These are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. Things that we can do as clinicians to make a difference with our patients now. So if you look at the slide, psychiatric emergency rooms are often the initial point of care for individuals with opiate use disorder. We want to develop the best practices for initiation of medication-assisted treatment in the emergency room, and then how we can connect our patients to outpatient follow-up following that. We want to identify the resources available in our own respective systems and how these can be used to effectively manage opiate use disorder. I gave you an example of what the emergency room does at VA Connecticut, but within your system, try to figure out what the best practices are for you. And then we want to incorporate a team-based care in an integrated medication-assisted treatment program, including connecting our patients to all the community services that are available. So hopefully you found this to be an interesting discussion. Tobias, I really want to thank you for being a part of this. Thank you for joining us. CME Outfitters has a wealth of information about safe pain management, best practices for pain management, best practices for opiate use disorder. For additional resources and other educational activities for clinicians and patients, please visit our Opiate Education Hub at www.cmeoutfitters.com. Again, Tobias, thank you very much, and we hope you enjoyed this.
Thank you, Brian, for having me. I hope it's of interest to the listeners today, so thank you.